Well, as Mark mentioned earlier, we're working through the book of Genesis, at least the first nine chapters or so, and we got to chapter 9. So far, in this particular story, the great narrative to do with Noah, we've seen that God sees a world of evil, a world like our world, where every inclination, the basic direction and drift of people's lives is away from God and towards themselves. God sees a world of evil, and God judges, but at the same time, God steps in to save Noah and his family by his surprising, remarkable grace and mercy and love. Great story of judgment and salvation. And we thought about that for the last 2 weeks, and now we're thinking about the after. You know how it is in any great story, if there's been some great epic battle or disaster, then there's noise, and there's rush, and there's chaos, and perhaps there's death, and there's destruction, and then suddenly there's quiet, and there's peace. And there's a few scratchings and scrapings and movements as the few people who've survived the battle or the disaster emerge and blink and see what's out there and try and rebuild. That's what's happening here in this story of Noah. Noah emerges, as we looked at last week, to discover a world kind of made new. And we're going to think about that new world for a moment now from these verses. First of all, Noah sees and discovers it's a world of blessing. He comes out, verse 18, and he responds, of course, at first in the best way anyone can respond to being saved in a disaster. What does he do? He wants to worship God. See that in verse 20. Noah built an altar to the Lord. Not the first time. Think about Abel who offered sacrifices, but a key moment when an altar is built and sacrifices are made to God. Noah wants to worship God. Do you want to worship God? Do you want to worship God when something good happens? At all key moments, we want to worship God. It's not like you have to have a church service every time something happens, but sometimes it's good together as a church family. So we have church celebrations for various things, and we celebrate weddings, and we want to say God is here, and we want to praise God. It's not just about the couple who are getting married. It's about doing it before God, and it's about giving thanks to God. So when good things happen, we want to worship God. That's what Noah does. And as Noah worships, God pronounces a blessing. God says, I'm going to bless. And let's think about what he says as he speaks to Noah. First of all, he says to Noah, be fruitful. See that in chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. Of course, Noah kind of sounds like, or his experience sounds like what happened to Adam, doesn't it? Where Adam was told, and Eve told the same thing, that same mandate. It's in chapter 1 and verse 28. Basically, it's have kids. Be fruitful and multiply. Have kids. Start again. Imagine these three women looking at each other and looking at their husbands and thinking, oh no, here we go. We've got to populate the whole earth. But there they are. That's their mandate. That's their responsibility. Fill the earth. Seems to have worked, doesn't it? You're here. Settlers made it all the way to the primitive land of Sussex and Hayward's Heath, and somewhere, someone built a house and another house and then a train station. And most of you here, God will bless you in families with children. It's part of God's blessing. Of course, like everything, it's twisted and bent out of shape by sin. So not all of us live in happy families. Not all of us kind of get what we expect in that way. But generally speaking, God blesses and continues to bless and allows us to fill, to populate, to multiply. It's part of God's blessing. Remember that. Remember that at 3 o'clock in the morning, you've got a young family, or at 3 o'clock in the morning and you've got old teenagers. Remember that God's blessed you if you have children. So blessing in being fruitful. They're to start again, like Adam and Eve were to populate the earth, so Noah and his family. Secondly, verse 3, eat everything. There's an invitation. Eat everything. Salad, vegetables, cereal, Many of you I know love cereal. Breakfast, best meal of the day, isn't it? Just get up, don't you get excited? You know, shall I walk the dog first? Shall I have my cereal first? It's a very difficult choice in the morning. Cereal's great, and you know, salad's okay, as long as you've got something else to have with it. And crisps. Oh, yeah. Crisps. They're always bad for you. You know, any kind of crisp bad for you, whatever they say. But they're really nice, aren't they? So eat plant life. And eat meat, like steak, barbecues, fish, even chicken. Can't go a year without mentioning chicken in a sermon. But even chicken, those stupid animals with small brains that are everywhere on our shelves, even eat chicken. All this meat for us to enjoy, it's there for you. Every time you have a barbecue, think, God's blessed us. I can eat meat, a big steak, a beef burger, sausages, bacon. You know, you're so blessed in this country. We're the only country you know what real bacon is. Travel anywhere else in the world, you realize they don't know what bacon is. It's kind of funny, thin stuff that's all streaky and fatty and crispy. But we know what bacon is. What a blessing. Eat meat. Now, of course, we're never encouraged to be greedy. In fact, quite the opposite. We're encouraged to be restrained and not to make an idol out of anything, including food. And of course, with our sedentary lifestyles, we sit down a lot. Too much fat is bad. And of course, we've got to think about the rest of the world and whether what we are eating somehow impoverishes the rest of the world. So we've got to think about all those things as well and be responsible about those things. But having done that and made a responsible choice, eat meat and enjoy it and give thanks to God for it. If you want to be a vegetarian, be a vegetarian. God's not asking you to be a vegetarian. Maybe something you choose to do. So eat meat. But in eating, respect animals. You see that God seems to be giving them meat as a new thing, and probably that is a new thing. See that at the end of verse 3, just as I now gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. That's probably a new command, although it's not totally clear whether it's just clarifying what was already the case. It just wasn't stated earlier. But certainly now meat is to be eaten, but it's to be eaten in a respectful way. There's these comments about lifeblood, isn't it? About not eating it with the lifeblood in it. And I think there's probably a couple of reasons for that. One is that if you imagine eating a live animal, it's very uncivilized, it's very unrespectful, and it's very primitive, really, in many ways. It's very cruel to the animal itself. So there is just, I think, the general principle of, Mark Driscoll puts it like this, make sure it's dead before you eat it. Make sure it's dead before you eat it. And I think that's part of a respect. You know, how cruel is it to eat a live animal? You can't imagine how cruel that is. So there's a respect aspect to eating, not with lifeblood in it, making sure it's dead. I think there's probably also a connection with pagan practices to say, those nations, by the time this book was being written, these first five books of the Bible, most probably written by Moses, they're going through to the Promised Land, they're surrounded by nations who worship idols and have all kinds of pagan practices, not worshipping God. And maybe part of that is eating live animals. So it's also talking about that. Don't eat live animals as a sort of pagan, uncivilized, brutal kind of ritual. So, be fruitful, have loads of kids, eat everything, respectfully, responsibly, but eat everything. And then respect human life above all life forms. God speaks about animals, and then verse 6, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made man. It's true since the beginning that it's wrong to murder. Of course, the first murder is Cain killing Abel, and it was wrong. But Noah's given here this key, kind of foundational statement in the Bible about murder being wrong. It's wrong because humans are made in the image of God, as we thought about, a couple of months ago now, at the beginning of Genesis. Humans made in the image of God. I don't know why it happens to appear here and not earlier. Perhaps as men were to move out and to become hunters. You see that meat are given to men, and it's meat that they're going to go out and hunt some of it. Maybe as they go out and hunt animals, rather than just have domesticated animals, maybe they're going to think, hunting's good, throw a spear at a deer, throw a spear at a man who's my enemy. Not a lot of difference, really. Perhaps that's why this appears here. But it's to show the value of human life. Human life's special. Human life's unique. Don't kill people. Respect human life. And it seems that one way of showing that we're serious about human life, one way of showing that we respect human life, is in the punishment given to those who murder. Now, of course, Christians argue, you would know this probably, about whether capital punishment is right, whether we should execute people who are proven to be murderers. And you could argue pluses and minuses about that. You could think about whether it's harder or more difficult to have wrong convictions now with all the DNA and forensic and all those things that we have. But whatever you decide, the way a society treats human life, the way a society values human life, the way a society deals with those who kill or who maim or who disrespect human life is kind of a measure of how civilized that society is. And I think the best way to reflect the fact that we're image bearers, executing murderers is the right thing. Seems to be the right thing here in Genesis, seems to be the right thing through the Bible. But whatever you decide, whatever a society decides, the way we deal with those who murder is a very significant barometer of how civilized we are. So respect human life. Respect human life above all life forms. There's not the same thing said about animals, that our life is demanded if we kill an animal. So cuddle a panda or a pussycat or a rabbit. Take them home. Have them as your friend. You don't have to eat everything that lives and breathes. So have pets. But they're not the same as humans. So you're driving down Haywards Heath High Street. And from the left, a kid runs out. And from the right, a cat runs out. Which one are you going to run over? You've got to choose. What are you going to do? The cat gets it every time. Doesn't it? Because you're making that distinction. Human life, cat's life. Human life, cat's life. Doesn't take long to figure out the cat gets it. And that works its way through how we think about animals. If a dog bites a man, certainly seriously bites a man, then we want to think about digging a hole to put the dog in. If a man bites a dog, then we think, guy needs therapy. Yeah. But we don't think, you know, let's put him in prison, do we? Maybe we do. Because it depends how severely. There may be good reasons for putting him in prison, but it's not the same, is it? So, we're responsible leaders of our creation, of God's creation. It's for us to enjoy. It's not for us to exploit. So we take care of animals. We're careful how they are killed for meat. We're careful how they are looked after as pets. Of course we are. But in the end, there is a distinction. Man here, all of animal life here. So value, respect human life above all life forms. You might not think so, but I love dogs, really. I love dogs. I have a dog. You may think I treat it badly, but I have a dog and I love them. And just paid quite a lot of money, or my insurance company has, for looking after the dog, dealing with a particular health issue with the dog. But apparently in this country, it's quite unusual that we have pet insurance. Here in America, are the only places that look after dogs and cats and other animals carefully. And I think that's a good thing. It's a good thing that I had insurance, otherwise, dilemma, really. £1,000. Anyway, but... So glad for insurance. But sometimes you would just wonder, you know, there was a news item on the other day, and there's an RSPCA man talking about cruelty to dogs in some way. And I think it is cruel, and it is distressing, and all those things. But you think, he's getting so excited about this, and babies are killed, and old people are killed, or bumped off in some other way, or not cared for. And there's a whole areas of human life that are not respected, and let alone the rest of the world where there is poverty, and there is illness and disease. Respect human life above all life forms. And we need to think how that works through into what we do. Running out of time. Okay, last thing in terms of blessing is the covenant. And I guess that's the most important thing, but I've been working my way to it. It's mentioned at the beginning, and then it's kind of sprinkled all the way through in the things that God says. It's the first time in the Bible we have a big statement about God making a covenant. And this first covenant, if you like, is a covenant with Adam and with all creation. It's a promise. It's an agreement. It's a commitment. A bit like a vow we might make in marriage or a contract we might enter into in business. God makes an agreement with people. It's a covenant on his side. He just says it in his grace. He says, this is how it's going to be. I'm making this agreement with you, Noah, and your family, and with all creation. And the covenant's a simple one, really. He says this, never again will there be a global catastrophe to judge the world. Never again will there be a global catastrophe to judge the world. Yes, there will be judgments and disasters. Sometimes they may be punishments. Sometimes they may be warning bells to get us to sit up and listen to the fact that God will one day judge all men and we need to turn to him. But never again will there be a global judgment. And the covenant sign of that, just like the wedding ring is a covenant sign of the marriage vow, the covenant sign for God's covenant with Noah is going to be the rainbow. We don't know whether rainbows appeared before then. You can have lots of scientific discussion about did the atmosphere change in some way with the Noah flood and so rainbows were now possible. Don't know, don't have a clue. But whether it was there already or whether it's new, God says, when you see a rainbow, remember, yeah, clouds come over and then the sun comes. And this is a sign. This is what you can look at and say, yeah, although the clouds are coming over, God's not going to deluge the whole world again in judgment. So it's a very appropriate sign, isn't it? And every time you see a rainbow, every time you feel the change in the seasons, it's autumn now, isn't it? Every time you feel a change, every time the light changes, it gets darker, it gets lighter as we work towards the summer or the winter, remember God's faithfulness to this promise. Because until the end of the world, God will keep everything turning, everything moving, everything changing, everything working. Now that doesn't mean that we can't damage things. Some people look at this text and they say, oh well, this means global warming's not happening. We can't possibly overheat the earth because God's promised everything will carry on and the seasons will continue as before. It's not a promise that says we can't damage the earth by the stupid things we do. You have to look elsewhere and think elsewhere about whether global warming's happening. That's a scientific discussion. And you have to think elsewhere about what we do about it if it is happening. It's a theological discussion about our responsibility as stewards. All this verse says, all this promise says, is that whatever happens, whether caused by us or caused naturally, as we might say, whatever happens, the fundamental properties of the seasons will continue, that God will be faithful to this earth till the end. Doesn't mean we can't do quite a lot of damage and even change things. So there's the covenant. It's part of the blessing. And we need to remember that. Every time it's summer, every time it's winter, every time a new day starts, every time it's raining, every time it stops raining, to thank God and say, you're faithful to creation. It keeps turning. It keeps moving. It keeps changing. It keeps working. So much then for blessing. The other thing we're just going to look at for a moment is the curse. I'm particularly looking from verse 18 onwards. You can get loads of children's books about Noah. Noah going into the ark. The animals in the ark. You can get mobiles for cots. You can get colouring books. There are nice arky-arky kind of songs. There isn't very much about verse 18 onwards from chapter 9. No arky-arky, drunky-drunky songs, are there really? And what's really clear and serious from these few verses is a few things. I suppose the obvious one on the surface is that sin came out of the ark. God's already made that clear, hasn't he, in verse 21 of chapter 8. Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil. But here from verse 18, we get an example of the fact that sin has come out of the ark. Sin went in the ark, judgment came upon the earth, but sin also comes out of the ark with Noah and his sons. Clearly, it's not been eradicated by the flood. The flood was just, the flood was fair, the flood was the right thing for God to do, but it wasn't a lasting cure. It was an expression of his wrath, and a fair expression. It was a foretaste of judgment to come. It didn't fully, completely deal with sin. So the new creation is partial, and it's incomplete. And Noah and the others, although Noah lives quite a long time, soon after, people's lifespan decreases greatly, and for all of them, they will die. And we see sin in two lives here. First of all, we see Noah's shame. Noah's shame in verse 21. Noah planted a vineyard. It takes some time for a vineyard to be cultivated and to grow, and you get the grapes and then to make some wine. So this must have taken some time. It's not like on a particular day he planted a vineyard and got drunk. Maybe he gets drunk because of his inexperience. He's the first person to drink wine. How much shall I have? You know, there's no guidance anywhere. So maybe it was his inexperience that caused him to be drunk, but probably not. It takes a while. I'm sure he could have experimented a bit with it. Maybe this was a one-off event. Maybe this was habitual. We're not really sure. But whatever happens, whatever led up to it, what actually happens on this particular occasion is that Noah's drunk. He's the equivalent of someone coming home drunk from going out to the pub or to the club and passing out in the hallway. And obviously it's wrong. And it's humiliating. That's Noah's shame. Most godly men, all godly men, do stupid things. Most godly men do very stupid things. Leaders in churches do stupid things, maybe things like this, maybe worse. Because sin is still with us. We do dumb things. We do shameful things. And the Bible doesn't say that's okay, but it does say this shouldn't surprise us. That because sin came out of the ark, even righteous people like Noah, people who fundamentally trust God, still do dumb things and shameful things. So there's Noah's shame in verse 21. But I think more so there's Ham's dishonor in verse 22. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. Now we can speculate for a long time about what saw his father's nakedness exactly means. Did he see Noah in his birthday suit? Did he see Noah and his wife naked? Did he see... There's a long list of things that this could refer to, which I'm not going to give you now, but you can ask me later if you really want to know. was Canaan somehow involved? Verse 24, it talks about the youngest son. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, Ham most probably was not the youngest son. Probably this youngest son thing refers to Canaan. But probably Canaan was also somehow involved with whatever took place with this dishonoring of Noah. Maybe that explains the severity of Noah's reaction. But even if it is as simple as it's described here, I think Oriental or a Middle Eastern culture would immediately understand what dishonor this is, how shameful this is. Here's an adult son, he's not like a giggling 10-year-old or something, and he dishonors his dad. You see, the thought is that he comes out from whatever's happened in there, either seeing or doing, and he comes out and he wants to tell his brothers. Basically, he wants to have a laugh about his dad. Yeah, look what I saw, look what I did, or look what happened here. How shameful is our dad? And he's dishonoring his father. Him and his son, probably Canaan, dishonoring his father. And so a curse falls on them. It's worth just thinking about that. That we need to respect those in authority, particularly those in authority in our family and in the country who deserve our respect. You see, it's not a cultural thing. Some cultures would immediately recognize this and say, yes, of course, respect for the family is fundamental. Pretty much in our culture, we don't think. We think people have to earn our respect, and that if people do stupid things, we have to shame them. You know, if somebody is prominent in public life, then if they do something stupid, if they do something shameful, they have to get into the news of the world or to the sun. I'm not saying people who do bad things should not be called to account. Of course, they should be called to account. But there is a culture of dishonor, of disrespect. And Ham illustrates that very well. And we can see that whatever the connection with Canaan and what he got involved in here, that disrespect, it runs through families. If you're a disrespectful son and you don't do anything about it, you will have disrespectful children. You will have misbehaving children. You will have children who have no respect for authority and who dishonor those who are in charge. It's hereditary. It works through families, as we see in the line of Canaan. So it's not a cultural thing. It's a God thing that we honor. Even failed parents, even failed authorities. So we see Ham's dishonor, but then we see Shem and Japheth's covering. In contrast to Ham, Shem and Japheth do something about Noah's nakedness. They think this is dishonorable, so they want to cover it up. Yeah, Dad's probably been stupid. He's been a fool. Dad is embarrassing. Dad has become a bit of a joke today, but he's still Dad. I want to honor him, and I don't want to make a joke of him. And they do the right thing. In some way, it's described for us here, and it's kind of comic, but it's kind of serious. It's not supposed to be a funny story, where they turn away from what's going on, from seeing Noah, and they pull a cloth over him to show respect for him, to say, he's our dad, he's been stupid, but we honour him and we want to cover over his shame. What a great example of family honour that is. And that is partly why it's there for us, just to show that Shem and Japheth are honouring their dad. But I think it's there for another reason. Because as we've been thinking about curse, we've been thinking that sin comes out of the ark as sin goes into the ark. And in Noah's shame, in Noah's sin, and indeed in Ham's, we see our own shame, we see our own sin. You see, I've already said about leaders, church leaders, people in prominent positions in life do shameful, they do stupid things, and it shouldn't surprise us. we do stupid and shameful things. And God does something amazing. God covers our shame. God covers our sin. God honours us, even though we're a joke. That's why Jesus came. That's why Jesus lived and died. That's why Jesus is now interceding for us in heaven, to cover our shame. All of us here have done shameful things. Fundamentally, we've done shameful things. We're naked, we're exposed, we're a joke because we haven't honoured God. But perhaps for some of you here, there's particularly shameful things. Not only do you know that God doesn't like what you've done, you know if people knew what you had done, you would be so much more ashamed. You would be so embarrassed. Maybe you wouldn't even be able to meet with them anymore, to see them anymore. You'd feel so shameful. God knows that. And the tremendously encouraging thing for us this morning is that just like these two sons of Noah covers the shame of Noah, God covers your shame. Whatever you have done, whatever you have said, however you have acted, wherever you have been, whoever you have slept with, whatever you have taken, whatever your shame, Jesus can cover that shame. Do you know that to be true for yourself? Do you know the experience of Noah? He's been an idiot, but his shame is covered. You've been an idiot. Your shame can be covered. Let me assure you of that this morning. Perhaps you've been a Christian a while and you're still not sure whether you're really forgiven. You're still not sure whether what you did can really be forgiven. Let me assure you. Jesus can cover your shame. Jesus can cover your sin. Jesus did really pay the penalty for all the shameful things you've done. And Jesus can give you a new life, a clean heart, forgiveness, righteousness to stand before God and to be in the right place. So let's remember, as they come out of the ark, there is blessing, there is curse. There are great things to enjoy in creation. There is the faithfulness of God. But let's remember sin. Let's push away sin in the dishonor that it creates within families and within societies. But let's remember that for all our shame, Jesus died to cover our sin and to make us right.